Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there, family. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are back. We had problems last week, but those things have been resolved, lesson learned, and will not be repeated. But we are back. This is your host, Atiba Buchanan. We are excited today. Joining me is my good friend and co-host, Mr. David Seaton, and my other co-host, Ms. Rashida Graham Washington. And I am honored to have both of you with me today. Rashida is still recovering, but she is being a trooper, and she is joining us today. So we thank her for that. Yeah, absolutely.
And we would be remiss if we didn't give a quick shout out to all of our listeners that heard our live broadcast when we broadcasted from the inaugural event from the LIVE organization sponsored by Ms. Rashida Graham. I just wanted to just mention that just because I know several people listened to that show and they commented on how they really, really enjoyed the format of that show.
Yeah, we had a good time doing it, didn't we, guys?
We had a great time.
We had a phenomenal time.
It was cold that night, though.
Holy Jesus.
It was cold indeed.
Man. It's like you, I'm glad you said that because it's like 180 degree, almost literal.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got a lot to talk about today. We've only got an hour to do it, so let's get to work, family. You know, as a matter of fact, you know, usually I have opening comments, but today I'm going to wait for a segment that I'll do later. We've got Cam Newton today, not on the show, but we'll be discussing we'll be discussing the dynamic and the phenomenon of not just his talent, but also a lot of the criticism that has been levied his way really throughout his professional career and even beginning in his collegiate career. And we're just assessing today how much of that criticism is warranted and how much of it could be steeped in racism or not understanding of culture. I think we'll even kind of parse that between race and culture today, but we got a lot coming up with that today, so stick with us for the hour. That's coming up at 20 after the hour, so hang with us. But right now, Ms. Rashida Graham Washington today is going to lead us, but we all have something to say, but she's going to lead us in a conversation about Ms. Janice Talton Jackson. I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to let Rashida, go ahead and set this thing up, and let's get to work.
Yeah, Janice Talton Jackson. And, you know, it is imperative that we say her name, Janice Talton Jackson, because it reminds us that she lived, that a week ago she laughed and breathed and had being, you know, in this world. A mother of three who lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 29 years old, and today, she's dead, murdered, shot and killed outside a bar early last Friday morning because a man made sexual advances towards her, and she said no. A man 12 years her senior approached her, and she simply declined, and then he took her life because she said no. This is a prime example of the ways in which entitlement continues to wrongfully claim lives in our country. This is a prime example of the ways in which the innocent and the vulnerable and the marginalized in this country must fight tooth and nail every day simply to preserve their own bodies and the freedoms that should be inherent to self-preservation, the freedom to gracefully and respectfully decline the advances of anyone who propositions someone else, and in this case, a black woman. So we want to hear from listeners today. I have a few more words to say about this, but please call in and talk to us at 657-383-0193. You know, sadly, the swelling statistics emerging from such incidents are astounding. The Center for Disease Control reports that at least 4 out of every 10 black women have been a victim of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner or someone who was hopeful to be an intimate partner. And sadly, I personally know more women who have recounted a narrative of abuse and disrespect following their repeal of a man's intimate advances most commonly concluding with a man shouting epithets of ridicule up to and usually including the derogatory term for a female dog, her punishment, I suspect, for not simply acquiescing to his advances. I've personally experienced such encounters more times than I can count. The mental and emotional acrobatics that a woman has to exercise in a matter of a moment to size up the optimal way to maneuver such circumstances are at a minimum exhausting, and at their worst, as in this case with our sister Janice, life-ceasing. And tonight we really want to hear from you. And totally inadequate, you know. And tonight we really want to hear from you, particularly from women who have until now not had opportunities to share your narrative and give voice to how this type of objectification usually affects you, as we now know, and mourn the toll this travesty has taken on the life and family of Janice Talton Jackson. So call us and talk to us, 657-383-0193. The lines are open, and I invite my co-host to chime in on this as well.
Well, I was going to say, and you put it more eloquently than I was going to say it, but in my lifetime, I've certainly been witness to it being in a group of men or coming out of a club or going into a club or just being in a social interaction where you have men and women there. A man approaches a woman, hey, let me get your phone number, blah, blah, blah. The woman says no, and then the dude calls the female a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember in my teenage years, and certainly in my early adult years, just cringing at what is it in a man's head that thinks that a woman who is a stranger owes him her phone number for there to be reciprocity in his advances, and when there isn't, that his resort is anger and to call that woman a bitch. I mean, resorting to violence.
Or anything outside of her name.
Anything outside of her name. It seems like violence is just one short step away.
Yeah. Let me do this. Let me even correct some of the framing of your question. You say, how can a man? I say, how can a male? Because if he was a man, he wouldn't take that. Men understand the value of women, and I think that is a male thing, someone who has not yet developed into a man. And how can we address that and help these young men or these males think and behave and understand more like what a man would do?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that is also true of a man is that a man understands that he must put forth a level of effort in order to acquisition what he desires. And in most of these cases, and certainly in every case that I have experienced where a male has reproached me for very gracefully and respectfully declining his offer, there was very little effort, very minimal effort put towards the advance in the first place. So to me, that's also the irony. You want to do little of nothing to acquire my attention. And then when I'm not accepting of the substandard way in which you approach me as a male and not a man, then your response is to try to punish me because you feel a sense of entitlement that you are owed something for the minimal effort that is usually attributed in these cases.
This kind of reminds me of Cologne, Germany,
mm-hmm.
where they had the refugees that came into Cologne, Germany, and then on New Year's Eve there were several hundred reports from German women that they were sexually assaulted and or accosted
mm-hmm.
on New Year's Eve by men who they identified as the men that fit the description of the gentlemen who were the refugees that were allowed sanctuary in Germany. It's so much larger, I think, than I think we make a mistake if we try to make this seem like a cultural thing. Is this just a man-woman thing? Is this just a is this a worldwide misogyny on steroids, forgive the pun, that men come from the place where they can approach women how they believe they can and get away with it?
Right. I mean, if you look at historically, from a pop culture point of view, you watch any kind of movie, especially from the 80s, you know, the dynamic of construction workers working and women walking past and catcalling, and it's almost expected for the woman to ignore them or not respond favorably, and for them to then, you know, you can just look right here, honey, it's right here. You know, those types of, and people laugh at that. That is part of our culture. And then I think what we're seeing then is an extension of what we've allowed to be acceptable, which really isn't, because no one's ever called it out, probably due to misogyny. And then we see in this situation with Ms. Jackson being the worst of those circumstances.
Sure.
Absolutely. You know, I think one thing to note here too is that though I can say that it has happened rarely, but a couple of times that I've experienced where it was a man and just myself and not a bunch of other people around. But in the example David gave in Germany, there were groups of men. And at a construction site, there are generally groups of men. And at a bar, there are usually groups of men. I certainly feel differently when a man makes an advance at me when his friends are around, and my ability to handle the situation well than I do when it's one-on-one. I feel like there's more of an opportunity for me to quell the situation one-on-one. There is a lot of groupthink and a lot of peer pressure, if you want to call it that, saving face, you know, face saving, that plays into the situation when men are with other groups of men. And I think that it's important for me to say that this is not just a woman issue, because if men were holding groups of men accountable and changing the culture of expectation in those situations where it was no longer collectively acceptable for an individual who's a part of that group to behave that way, it would mitigate significantly the number of advances that turned out the way this did.
I certainly think there's some responsibility for men to hold one another accountable. I think the larger issue, though, if we want to get to a solution, is that, and this is unfortunate to have to say, but there are just some common sense things that women need to do, like traveling in groups. You know, I've seen plenty of shows where they talk about women and learning self-defense, and I've even heard where women, if a woman is approached by a man and it's just one-on-one, that she shouldn't yell help, because people don't respond to help. She should yell fire. Because if she yells fire, people will respond to that. I don't know. Are we talking about just a dumbing down of the culture in terms of our connection to one another and our responsibility to one another? I remember there was something that happened in New York where a woman was being attacked on one of those bridges, and I can't remember the bridge, but they were talking about the Good Samaritan law and invoking that, that people were just driving by and just not paying attention because it didn't involve me. I don't want to get involved, kind of thing.
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Ms. Graham?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point, and I think it goes hand in hand with what I was sharing, is that if men sort of have a code of understanding amongst themselves that individual men are held accountable to. And also, you know, I think that, as I think about what you just shared about, oh, well, women should, you know, kind of be able to travel in groups together and, you know, be able to help each other by being a collective. I think that works sometimes. But I think I think we have to be careful to put the onus of men's behavior in terms of the provocation on the heads of the women who are victims in this case. Much like when we talk about racism, oftentimes you will hear me say that white men need to be the first voices to speak out against racism, because they're the ones who stand to bear the most privilege as a result of racism. And so in this case, I would say the same thing, that men you know, we talk about even human trafficking, which is maybe a byproduct of this kind of behavior. There are more women trafficked. The most trafficked day of the year is Super Bowl Sunday for all kinds of obvious reasons. And so if we could deal with the person who is the client of human trafficking and mitigate that clientele, then there would be no market for human trafficking to occur. If we can get men to hold men accountable to a higher standard. And I think also, David, what you said is true in general, and I pointed to this sense of entitlement that is pervading our country, but there's also this sense of human neglect that I totally concur with, that we see things happening and we turn our head. And I wonder to what extent women are even starting to do that so that they're not the target in this case. Like, well, if he's picking on this woman, then I'll turn my head so I don't have to be the one who, you know, suffers the snare as well.
Let me do this.
One woman recounted online, I mean, this thing is so, you know, you wonder to what extent it can go, and I guess the answer is, you know, murder in the case of Janice Tolson Jackson. But so many offenses even happened before that. One woman recounted online this week that a man had gone so far as to spit in her face at her repeal of him. And so that becomes a question of, like, solidarity. And I think it also goes back to parenting. I mean, not many things don't when you think about it. David, you nor Atiba would ever approach a woman in this way because of the way that your mothers have sown seeds into your lives. And we wonder now how many other mothers are doing that in this day and age with their sons.
Let me do this. Let me introduce a couple of stories to try and give this thing some context as to how pervasive this really is. In trying to Google Miss Jackson's name in preparation for this show, unfortunately, I wasn't able to find it because there were so many other similar stories that had happened to other women in the United States over the years that I couldn't even find her story based on finding woman shot because she said no. So I was able to find the website called When Women Refuse. It's on Tumblr, and it's a site that allows women to share their stories about things that have happened to them. So when we talk about men being accountable, one story really stuck out to me. It's titled, "They Threw Drinks All Over Us." And it only take a moment to read. It says, "It was an early evening, and a group of six of us, all female, were walking to a bar for a drink after work. A big black 4x4 drove past and slowed down alongside us. The windows were then rolled down, and three men inside started hitting on us and asking us to go out to drinks with them. We said no, thank you. They aggressively hurled abuse at us, calling us sluts and telling us that we were all ugly anyway," which I don't know why guys do that. "They sped up to drive on, at which point my friend disgustedly stuck her middle finger up at them as they drove off. They saw this, reversed, wound down their windows, and threw fruit juice all over us. As ridiculous as it sounds, as a group of 25 to 30-year-old women, we were terrified at being both verbally and physically threatened by three anonymous men for no other reason other than we weren't interested in going out to drinks with them. They sped off laughing. We all stood in fearful silence and abject disbelief at what had just happened." So again, here we have a group of men, no one holding each other accountable. They're all participating and leaving these women, again, in a state of shock, again, for just trying to mind their business and get to wherever it is they were going. And I think that is indicative, again, because this ranges from, you know, being called outside of your name to everything in between up until murder. And we absolutely have to address this dynamic.
I'm sure we can talk about
the entitlement is far and wide reaching because just at the end of 2015, last December, a woman was addressed by a man. She declined. She told her boyfriend about it because he was repeatedly approaching her. Her boyfriend very graciously and politely said, "Hey, this is my girlfriend. She's not interested." And they went on at the party, and when they got ready to leave, the man who had been approaching his girlfriend was standing outside with a gun and shot the young man in the chest and killed him. So even trying to, you know, something that we used to hold up as a really significant way of supporting and caring for your woman could leave you dead in this day and age.
So that brings a whole new context to the phrase, chivalry is dead.
Exactly.
It is. Exactly. Yeah, you got to be really careful.
Wow.
There are tons of resources out there for learning more about the issue. PoorHarriet.com is one place to go. The book Too Heavy a Yoke by Shaniqua Walker Barnes. Any book by Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Nikki Giovanni, Gwendolyn Brooks, Sonia Sanchez. There are tons of local female spoken word artists who really speak to this as an issue. And finally, we need to be really listening, not just to the mouth, but to the heart. And demeanors of our girls and young ladies and women when they have these sorts of things going on in their lives and they want to share them.
Well, we could certainly, I think, we could take this all day. Again, we're going to transition right now to the story of Cam Newton, and we do have a speaker that's coming on, a guest coming on, someone that all three of us have known for years. What's going on, man?
Hey, how's it going, guys and girls?
Hello, how are you?
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Let's talk about who you are. For anybody that doesn't know, that did not see the invite, for this conversation today on Cam Newton and Race, we invited Mr. Johnny Darling. He is homegrown, Proviso West alumni. He is out in South Carolina right now, correct, Johnny?
North Carolina.
Even better. And he's out in North Carolina. He is the host of Hump Day Radio. They have a phenomenal podcast that comes out every week, sometimes twice a week. And if for anybody that doesn't know, if they'd like to catch up on your podcast, now you want to tell them how to hear that real quick?
Yes, they can go to humpdayradio.com and hear what we have current or listen to any of the archive shows.
Absolutely, absolutely. I listen to his show weekly, and I enjoy it immensely. It is just kind of a real talk, kind of barbershop format kind of thing. So if you want to peek in the window of our community, but at the same time hearing intelligent discourse, much like us, definitely I would recommend listening to Hump Day Radio. We're glad to have you on. You're also teaching, right, Johnny?
Yes, I teach radio broadcasting at the Carolina School of Broadcasting.
There you go.
Excellent.
So I don't think we could have a more qualified person on today to talk about Mr. Cam Newton, and I am excited, Johnny. So let's start with a little bit of sound, if you don't mind. We got some sound from YouTube, and this is we're going to just listen to about a minute or so of some of the criticisms that have been levied at Cam Newton.
Okay.
With the first pick in the 2011 NFL Draft, the Carolina Panthers select Cam Newton, quarterback, Auburn.
He has yet to prove he can handle volume in a playbook. He looked to the sidelines for plays at Auburn and showed marginal field vision in a simplified run-first, dive-option offense. Even more concerning, he has a track record as an undependable, non-trustworthy, fake rah-rah leader at a very key leadership position and could always struggle to win a locker room.
Only 1 year as a starter in a very simple college offense. Character questions are a big concern.
We hear Casey Joyner say, don't take him in the first round. Does he have a point, Derek?
I would not take him number one. I'm the Carolina Panthers, Derek Brooks, defensive-minded guy. I would not take him.
Attributes that Cam Newton brings to the game have not translated into the NFL very well. I would put it to you this way. Who in the history of the NFL who's won a championship looks like Cam Newton?
I'm not a Newton fan. I thought, not at all. No, not at all. I didn't like him in college. He's technically as a quarterback. He's late. Gafford down in Jacksonville. These young kids, as far as I'm concerned, are far ahead of Newton as far as being an NFL quarterback.
Because I've said all along, I don't think Cam's worth a top 10 risk.
In the words of one general manager that I spoke to last night, he's a narcissistic con artist.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of this guy. This isn't punt, pass, and kick now. Okay. Did he win because he threw the ball? At our level, he's got to throw the ball. My biggest problem with this guy is...
All right, that's all I could take, Johnny. You got to jump in there, man.
See, that just goes to show you the so-called pundits and experts get it wrong, and they got it wrong this time, big time. Because I don't know if you guys have seen just this week, Rich Eisen put together a list of Cam stats, his first 5 years. Unbelievable. I knew the young man was doing a good job because I'm right here in Charlotte. Bank of America Stadium is literally from my door to the stadium, right on my street I live on, 12 minutes. So it's right down the street from me. He put together, and Rich Eisen put together and showed how in a five-year time span, Cam Newton's stats could be compared to anybody in NFL history, and he's number one in any five-year span of any quarterback ever.
But I thought he was a narcissistic con artist, and he was a fake rah-rah leader.
Well, that just goes to show you. The propaganda machine was in works. And
so,
it didn't translate to what he can do in the field.
So here's a question I have for you, Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that the pundits were wrong. The question is why? Was it simply not understanding to properly assess his skill level, or were these criticisms rooted in something else?
Well, I think twofold. One, they were rooted in a rookie quarterback, unproven, and there has not been an African-American quarterback or a black quarterback, however you want to term it, that has done what he's done, that has put up the type of numbers that he has. So that hasn't been seen. So if that's true, they didn't have a baseline to compare it to. Very few quarterbacks in the history of the game have done what he's done. So for that, I can say yes. But on the flip side of that coin, it's clear to see they did to him what they do to all black athletes in the media. And I'm a part
Johnny,
of the media,
wanna,
I understand.
Right, and we definitely, for those of you who are out there, we want to hear from you. Please feel free to call us at 657-383-0193. That number again, 657-383-0193. So just really quickly, I want to give a little historical context in the NFL, and I could talk about baseball and the NBA, but we're going to leave it to the NFL right now. In 1944, there were no African-Americans in professional football. In 1946, Marion Motley is the first black in professional football. In 1960, the proportion of blacks in the general population approximated the percentage of blacks playing professional football. In 85, it was 52%. In 98, it was 65%. And I think today it's just north of 73%. But speak to the prevailing wisdom or the prevailing belief that obviously still exists today that African Americans are not smart enough to be quarterbacks. And does that play a role in Cam Newton's perception in general?
Oh, it does. It clearly does, because you don't see what's happening with Cam happening anywhere else. And I just told a buddy of mine earlier today, in 10 years, Cam is going to be the blueprint. Watch, in 10 years, we will see that position change, which means general managers, owners are starting to realize that if you can get a quarterback that can pass and can run, it's like getting a twofer. You get two for one. And it's always been the only thing that has held black quarterbacks is that stigmatism that, oh, they aren't smart enough to run this position, they can't handle the mental pressures of it. That's not true. There have been black quarterbacks since the beginning of time that were smart enough, had the athleticism to do it, but they weren't given the opportunity. And we all know, all of us.
Let's talk about this then, because Cam Newton, like you said, his skill set is he can throw, he can run. He's had amazing stats in both figures, but Russell Westbrook can throw and run. Why is he more acceptable and palatable than Cam Newton? What's the difference?
The game. He does the song and dance. See, if you're going to be at that leadership position of a quarterback, you're the leader of the team, the leader of the franchise player. And on any level, whether it's high school, college, you're typically going to be the franchise or the figurehead player. They want that player to be well-spoken, to kind of toe the line and step and not be brash and bold, be humble, and just be a leader and don't get too crazy. But when you're a black quarterback, if you are, God forbid, brash or bold or confident, it's something where, oh, I don't like him, he's arrogant. Well, he's confident. I mean, there's a guy called Aaron Rodgers. When he scores a touchdown and celebrates, they even have commercials. He does a discount double check. Nobody says that. I mean, realistically, he does.
I think we've seen this phenomenon in so many places where black men are concerned. You know, we could talk about the Tuskegee Airmen and have a conversation about, you know, the ways in which the military has played out this same sort of issue. You know, we could talk about the President of the United States in some regard and talk about him and what has transpired in the last 7 years and the ways in which the role has been totally denigrated and disrespected the second that a black man hit the seat. I think that this issue that Cam Newton is facing is not in any way insular to the sports field. This is something that happens to brothers whenever they endeavor to do something, and that usually turns out as remarkable as the work that Cam Newton is doing. The question becomes, when will we see that trend? Like, when will majority of culture folks look back at history and start to name this trend that expands across industries?
Absolutely. We've had some excellent I was able to get some excellent sound as well. Opinion from a black man, a former football player Ryan Clark, who seemed to think that the problem with Cam Newton, or the problems people have with Cam Newton, I should say, is that they don't understand the culture rather than race. And let's take a listen and then see if we can parse that a little bit. Go ahead.
In a way that was easy to understand, in a way that was easy to accept. Here's the problem. He's actually wrong, though.
Explain.
Here's why he's wrong. Now, and it's always touchy, especially, you know, I'm a black analyst, you know, and so when we come to the defense of black players and we speak about race, everybody always thinks it's about racism. This isn't about racism. It's not. He's not disliked because he's brown-skinned. He's disliked because it's culturally hard to understand for most people. See, for many years, if you look at the black quarterbacks that were accepted, it wasn't about skill set. Right, we saw Randall Cunningham play very much like this. The plays weren't called for him, but he played very much like this. Russell Wilson is a brown quarterback. But Russell Wilson's culture is easier to understand. Russell Wilson doesn't dance. Russell Wilson doesn't have the hip-hop culture. Young Jeezy and Future aren't going to Russell Wilson games. So for the Caucasian fan, for the fan who doesn't understand that culture, Cam Newton's culture is too young hip-hop, too young brown, right? Because Aaron Rodgers, so we were less offended. Listen, I've been around all these quarterbacks. I was having a talk with a 10-year vet of the NFL, his wife. He's a quarterback in the NFL. And the first thing she said about when Cam Newton won, he just rubs me the wrong way, and I don't know why. And so I had to sit here and have
I think that pretty much says it, right?
Yeah. That sums up the whole that sums up how country as a whole. When you're good, they're looking to tear you down at any opportunity that's given to them.
But it's because
and
they don't understand
the sad
culture
thing
is because they don't understand race.
They don't understand. It's a combination of both. But a lot of it, those same people, when you're coming up and they're trying to recruit you or to get you to go to their colleges, they like the fact that, oh, that you represent the culture and that you're all this. But once you start having success, they want you to change and conform. Oh, no, we don't like that now. Now you have to become. You're representing us. You're part of our brand. So now we don't want the hip-hop culture.
He went on to say, because the sound was fairly long. It was about 5 minutes. We couldn't do the whole thing, but he went on to say that, you know, when you talk about the quarterback position in particular, that people expect a certain level of decorum. As a matter of fact, Brian Urlacher just this week was cited as saying he wished that Cam Newton had the class of Peyton Manning. And, you know, which I found amazing for him to frame it that way, because I'm sure if Cam Newton played for the Bears while Brian Urlacher was there and he was his quarterback and the Bears went 15-1 and went to the Super Bowl, I'm sure Urlacher would have absolutely no problem with whatever Cam Newton's behavior would be. As a matter of fact, I'm sure he'd punch somebody in the face if they criticized his quarterback. So I just thought that was a touch hypocritical. But what is it about this thing that black people are expected to behave, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, a certain way?
It is about where we come from and knowing our place in this country and the constant reminder of our place in this country. Please understand that everything that is done is to make sure that we as a people, as a culture, understand our place. It was we knew where our place was when we were free labor. Now we're
so
not
Cam
free
Newton
labor.
Is pushing the boundaries of that is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. And the
so some people may not know.
Boundaries is success.
Some people may not know. What we're speaking of. Can you just kind of name some of the things that Cam Newton does that some people have found so offensive?
Oh, he celebrates. He does his Superman, his chest Superman thing when he gets an end zone. He does the dab. He goes and he's giving away balls to all these kids at the game. I mean, he's doing nothing more than having fun. And one of my favorite all-time quarterbacks who celebrated and had fun, lived and played this game like it was his last, was Brett Favre. He played with so much excitement and exuberance that it was unreal and it was infectious to watch. Cam is now doing the same thing. He's excited. He's having fun. Through all the pressures we put on these athletes, it is a sport in essence. It's still a sport. It's a business, but it's also just a sport. They're not
it's entertainment. It's not even
it's
a sport.
Sport.
It's entertainment.
Exactly.
And let's talk about his excellence and juxtapose all this against the excellence of what we're talking about. We're talking about a team that just in this year alone, and their winning actually extends to last season, but this year alone are 15-1. They're only 16 games in the season. They went 15-1. They've obviously won every game that they've played in the playoffs, and they are not just winning. They are decimating opponents, and Cam Newton has been the leader in that. Certainly, it's a team sport. They're an excellent team as it stands. But not only has he been an excellent quarterback, but all the talk this year has him being an excellent leader as well. And it flies into the face of things like character questions and narcissistic con artist and a fake rah-rah leader. Those things are so far beyond the pale and so complete polar opposite of an accurate description of him. One can only wonder, and as African-Americans, I don't think people understand the labor that we have to go through. I had a friend of mine who was Caucasian who commented on Facebook when I posted the show. His suggestion was that we were looking for something to complain about. And what I ultimately had to explain to him was, as an African-American in this country, we have to evaluate everything through the lens of racism. And sometimes we conclude it's about racism. Sometimes we are able to conclude that it's not. Sometimes it's undecided. But we always have the labor of having to do that. And people in the majority, and I don't think it's sometimes necessarily a race thing. Sometimes it's just a matter of being in the minority or in the majority. But there are people in the majority that don't have that pressure and they cannot relate to it.
Yeah. And I think that's where the discomfort lies. Because you have this 6'5", 250-pound black man leading this great team, having fun while he's doing it. So you have to look at that and say, wait a minute, we can't have this. This looks too positive. People might start, there are young boys that might start thinking that this could be them.
And the other thing we have to consider is race has been a prevalent part of sports since we've had sports in this country. So when you go back and you look at, the first thing I think of is Serena Williams when I look at the criticism of Cam Newton. She's operated in that same excellence. She's been the number one player in the world for some time. She is on the cusp of tying the most number of Grand Slams. She's often beating foreign competitors from France or Germany or Russia, whatever country you want to name. And yet here in her own country, she can't seem to get the support that she deserves and that she's earned. And we can only question whether or not it is because she's black.
I mean, we all know that that's what it is. Quiet, we do. And I think even the larger society, they understand it, but they're so born into it that they don't really think about it on a regular basis. But that's exactly the issue. I mean, if you take it back to, like you said, Serena, we can go back to years prior. Somebody like Josh Gibson or Sandro Page in the Negro Baseball League, all the records that unofficially they have would tear down every Babe Ruth record, all those guys would totally destroy it. But they got discounted. Oh, that's the Negro League. That's not anything. But they wouldn't let those players play in Major League Baseball because they knew, wait a minute, they come in here, it's going to, we'll look like we inferior.
Let me ask you this, as we kind of bring this segment to a close, and forgive my choice of words here. Is the real solution to this issue changing or diversifying the racial makeup in the front office and in the ownership, as opposed to or compared to the racial makeup of the field? And forgive my choice of that word. It just seemed historically appropriate to say the field versus the house where the decisions are made. But again, if you look at the NBA, if you look at baseball, if you look at football, overwhelmingly the players over the years have become increasingly African American, but the ownership and the management and the people who are the decision makers, those numbers haven't moved as aggressively.
Which is why I don't think we're going to see change. Because those who have the power are going to do everything in their power to keep it. They're not going to relinquish it. Even if they bring in a few extra minorities in the organization, they're not the decision makers. And I just, call me a cynic, I just don't believe we'll see it in our lifetime like that. I really don't. It's sad. It should happen that way, but I don't think we're going to see it.
Johnny, we're not supposed to end on a sour note, man.
Well, let's end on this one. If and when the Carolina Panthers defeat the Denver Broncos for this Super Bowl, which I'm pulling for, you know, I'm a diehard Bears fan. Let's get that out there, hometown. But I am rooting, and I'm a bandwagon fan now of the Panthers. If this young man pulls off and gets this Super Bowl and never plays again, he has Hall of Fame numbers and a resume to go right along with it.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think they're going to do it.
What he's accomplished, no matter what, cannot be taken away from them. Let's go ahead and do this real quick. We'll end this segment on this. Let's get out some Super Bowl picks. Who do you got, Dave?
I'm about to go with Cam.
David's going with Cam. Who are you rolling with, Johnny?
Definitely Cam.
Absolutely. Well, I'm definitely rolling with Cam, and it's not because he's black. It's because I think he's a better quarterback, and they have a better team. The Denver Broncos have been able to do some amazing things this year, and they've been very lucky to do it. I think Peyton Manning threw for 176 yards last week. And Who throws 176 yards and beats Tom Brady? So they've been lucky, and I think their luck is going to run out Sunday. Rashida, who do you have?
I got Cam all the way.
Absolutely. We're going to take one quick call on this. Hold on. Thank you for calling. You're calling into We Hear You, where we find the humanity in the headlines. What's your name and where you're calling from?
My name is John, and I'm calling from Alabama.
Sure, John. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, my comment is, like, I see a lot of people, like, trying to turn this, like, whole Cam thing into, like trying to turn the media is trying to turn this into, like a race thing. Let me tell you something, man. Me, from my perspective, is, you know, I'm an Alabama fan. Cam came from Auburn. You know, the national championship stayed in the state of Alabama for, I think, 5 years at one point. It stayed in the state of Alabama. I was happy to see Cam win it at Auburn. But for me personally, as an NFL fan, it's nothing of race or anything like that. It's the fact that Peyton's had a wonderful career in the NFL. He's done better things in the NFL than he ever did at Tennessee. And he was a perfect quarterback for the NFL. And to me, I think this is Peyton's last rodeo, and it's just like I did when Ray Lewis was going for the Super Bowl in his final game. I want to see Peyton go out on top because he's had such a wonderful career. And it was the same way for me with Ray Lewis. I wanted to see, the Ravens go out, with him on top. And to me, that's why I'm rooting for the Broncos.
I think that's admirable. I think that's great. And to be honest with you, that is the essence of the sport, right? So it is a luxury to be able to assess the sport for what it is, not include all these other factors, and just really appreciate both talents, because Peyton Manning is certainly a talent, for who and what they are. So I am not here to suggest that every black person that's rooting for Cam is rooting for him because he's black, nor am I suggesting the opposite, that every white person rooting for Peyton Manning is doing so because he's white or because they're white. It's just that it is an undercurrent of what happens. It always has been in sports. And if you're able to parse that out and that's not a part of your evaluation, I would say bravo to you, my brother.
Yeah, and it's just like people are making a big deal about it this year, and I have no idea why, because, I mean, do they not remember a guy named Russell Wilson that also won the Super Bowl not too long ago, and he's a black guy too? So, I mean, if anybody wants to bring race into this, it just shows their stupidity and their ignorance because, I mean, Russell Wilson, he won the Super Bowl. He's black. I mean, you could go back through history. I mean, it doesn't matter what, Alabama, people accuse the state of Alabama of being so racist. But last year, you look at our team from a year ago, they take a halfback that, Blake Sims, and then Lane Kiffin turns him into this guy and makes him look great. So, sports. People need to leave race at the door when it comes to sports, because it doesn't matter. You just root for the team. You don't root for the individual.
Well, we appreciate your perspective today, man. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, just a kind of a coattail on what John said. Again, that's absolutely the case, that race should not be an issue. But, again, we have to remember in baseball, in basketball, and in football, that for years, for decades, in all three of those sports, African Americans were not allowed to play in those sports. And then when they finally came into those sports, that there were still decades after that that they weren't allowed to play in particular positions, specifying it to the NFL and the quarterback position, because the prevailing belief was African Americans weren't smart enough to play that position. And that's why we're having the conversation through this lens, and that's why Cam Newton is the appropriate individual to be discussing, because he's been so successful this season.
And that's the other thing, too, the comparison to Russell Wilson, which is why we tried to bring it up earlier, is a nuanced conversation, because it goes beyond just simply the color of his skin. Yes, Russell Wilson is black, but Russell Wilson doesn't behave like Cam Newton. And again, in Ryan Clark's earlier comments that we didn't get a chance to play all of, one of the reasons he says Russell Wilson doesn't dance is because he can't.
Another stereotype destroyed when we hear you.
Exactly. So it goes, so to simply compare them in their blackness, again, is an oversimplification. I understand his point, but again, there's more to it than that. And that's why we raised the question, is it about culture or is it about race, or is it a combination of the two? And it's probably where the two intersect is what we're talking about.
Johnny, any closing words?
Great
thoughts?
Perspective. Man, I thought he was right on, and it shouldn't matter. The world we live in, those who don't have to walk in our shoes, they don't get it. We experience race every day of our lives. We can't hide it. We can't deny it. And it's around us and what we do. And in athletics, it is major. You see it from the players to the coaches who have shorter leashes than other coaches to definitely upper management. So
absolutely.
Let's say, change the complexion of it all or the mindset, get people who understand that culture, and we'll see some changes.
Well, Johnny, we thank you so much for being on with us today, my brother.
Man.
Again, he is the host of Hump Day Radio. Please give them a listen. They are doing excellent. excellent work, much very similar to what we are, but you know, we certainly don't talk about the same things every week. I've heard some very unique, interesting conversations on Hump Day Radio. And again, keep doing your great work at the Carolina School of Broadcasting, churning out more good talent. And again, man, you have a great day, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Johnny, guys,
for having me.
Thank you, Johnny.
All right, so right now we've got a few minutes left. We've got about 10 minutes left to wrap up a few loose ends, and we're going to go right to it. So, Mr. Seaton, if you could go ahead and lead us in the discussion then about the latest in the Oregon standoff and give our listeners an update on that.
In the Oregon standoff, we had the FBI that apprehended, I believe it was five gentlemen. There was a shootout, and they had one gentleman, Lavoy. I can't remember his last name, but his first name was Lavoy, and I know I'll never forget that. That just stuck out in my head. He was shot and killed, and we still have four or five militiamen that are still held up in the Oregon facility. They are saying that they are going to stay there, that, you know, they're talking about their Second Amendment rights and the federal government and blah, blah, blah. It's amazing to me, not to get into, you know, not to get all into the specifics of the story, but just kind of remain higher level. It's amazing to me that the FBI allowed these Oregon militiamen to take possession of this federal building for 3 weeks before they intervened. And it's kind of funny how they even caught them. They caught them while they were on their way to dinner to another city. So they didn't confront them in or, you know, at the actual federal building. They caught them while they were making, I know Bill Maher made a joke and said that how serious should your group be taken if you are apprehended by the FBI while you're making a beer run.
Right.
So they were apprehended again. One man shot and killed by the FBI. It really just begs the question how the Second Amendment is viewed through a different lens depending upon what group you come from, and how your Second Amendment rights are respected depending upon what group you come from. What do you think about that, Rashida?
Well, I find it all quite interesting, as I'm sure you do, David. What I love, though, is even this past week when one of the guys was shot and killed, I believe it was the New York Times, LA Times, one of the Times actually called him, LA Times, called him an activist. And that really underscores the comment you just made. Perspective.
I'm glad
is everything,
you mentioned that.
Yes.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, because on MSNBC, when the shooting happened, they were referred to as protesters.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So we had them called protesters. When did it become in politics to call individuals terrorists? That's what they're doing.
Right.
They were terrorizing this local town. All the people in that local town were going to the sheriff and saying they wanted these people out of the community, but they've been called everything but what they are, terrorists.
Well,
that's right.
If I could join in the conversation for a second, I just want to get a little petty. First of all, his name was Lavoy Finicum.
That's right.
So we just want to get that on record as to what his name was. And I want to talk about his first name. His name is spelled L-A, or capital L, lowercase a, then capital V-O-Y. I would have thought he was black. Lavoy?
Lavoy.
Come on, man. Let's be honest. That's why he's a militia member, because nobody will call him back on his resume.
Lavoy.
Lavoy.
Again, no, not Finicum. Finicum,
I'm sorry.
Right, Finicum might have made sense. Somebody might have given the benefit of the doubt.
Lavoy. I've never heard that name before.
I know a lot of white people. I've never met one named Lavoy.
We hear you at the end of the show.
Right. So all I'm saying is, I know this dude probably could relate to some issues, because he sent out quite a few resumes, I'm sure. And he wasn't getting the call back because his name was Lavoy.
Okay. Wait. And let me just segue really quickly. What are these militiamen doing that they just are they taking a leave of absence from their jobs for 3 or 4 weeks?
Let's talk about LaVoy.
And wait. And as a gun owner myself, as a gun owner myself, I don't have a concealed carry, but as a FOID card carrying person in the state of Illinois and having purchased and owned handguns in the past, I can speak from my personal experience. Firearms are not inexpensive.
No, they're not.
So again, I'm trying to figure out how did this group of men take off their jobs for 3 and 4 weeks at a time, and they've got all these firearms and all this ammunition, and they just decide to just one day, hey, we're gonna go take over this federal building, but then they go online and ask people to send them snacks and juice and food and socks.
So let's talk about LaVoy. He has had 50 foster children, which is another reason I thought he was black.
You are just feeding John stereotypes down.
I know, right?
John, if you're listening, we're joking, okay? John and Alabama, we're joking.
And I thought he was black. So, I mean, this guy has had 50 foster children. That's been a lot of the articles that have come out. A lot of these people are gaming the system. Because, again, even if you go back to the grandfather of all this, Bundy, he is someone using federal land for free for 20 years. And that's basically what you've got here is people that are gaming the system, whether it's Social Security disability, because a lot of them are on disability, whether it is foster children, whether it is using federal land for free, they are gaming the system. Thus, they have all the time in the world to sit around and protest. Another reason I thought they were black.
See, Tom Hartman on the Tom Hartman Show on WCPT on 850 AM radio in Chicago, he made a really good point. He said that he was talking about how these militiamen were talking about the federal government was taking their land.
Right.
And that it was causing that they shouldn't take their land. They were making some connection to their cattle overgrazing. And the point that Tom Hartman made was the reason that they kept letting their cattle go onto federal land is because they were overgrazing on their own land.
Yeah.
That's why they had to go to federal land, because there was nothing else for them to eat.
Yep.
On their privately owned land. And then they didn't want to pay the little fee to the federal government. I can't understand.
So where are we now? So we have 4 guys left in this building.
There are 5 gentlemen that are still left in the, I believe it's 5 men, that are still left in the federal building, and they are not surrendering.
Right. So we've been through this. We know that if they were black, what would have happened? We have enough history to dictate.
We know what would have happened if they were Muslim.
Oh, God knows. We think we probably, if they were Muslim,
if a dozen Muslim men took over a federal building, I think we can say with certainty what would have transpired.
Right. And any scenario we come up with, I don't think would be beyond the pale.
Not at all.
The one thing that I am encouraged about, and hang with us because we're going to go over today. We still need to talk about Flint for a few minutes. You can listen to the entire show on at blogtalkradio.com/wehearya. Okay. I thought it was /. /wehearya. And again, you can go to our Facebook page. Please like us at wehearya and follow us on Twitter at wehearya too. We want to thank Johnny Darling for being with us today. And we want to thank Breon Jones for producing another excellent show. And just hang with us. Again, we've got a few minutes. We're going to do Flint, because we definitely got some updates to talk about with that. So let me close in just saying this. The one reason I'm glad that this thing happened in Oregon is that, in my opinion, this is just a TIBA, it completely shut down any more arguments about whether or not white privilege exists.
True.
To me, it is irrefutable, undeniable that this is a function. And again, not just this situation, because it started with their father, Cliven Bundy. Because had that situation been rectified the way that it was supposed to, this probably wouldn't have happened.
True.
So again, it just completely eliminates that whole deal. And from now on, you know, anytime we want to talk about white privilege, we can just go straight to this. We just put this right in the dictionary, because this is a perfect Again, picture perfect example of what white privilege is.
Imagine, Rashida and Atiba, imagine with me if 24 African Americans or 24 Muslims with AK-47s or AR-15s or handguns or grenades or whatever took over the Daily building in downtown Chicago. Or took over any federal building in the city of Chicago.
Right.
It wouldn't have lasted more than an hour, I tell you that.
Right.
I mean, I remember when we were in high school at Proviso West in Hillside, Illinois, when the local police then, if there were too many African Americans standing on the corner just hanging out, they were trying to charge them with mob action.
Yeah.
That's right.
No guns. I mean, there might have been a slingshot between them.
Right.
With no rock.
You could charge a dozen black teenagers with mob action for hanging out on a corner.
Yeah.
But you allow these militiamen, quote unquote, to stay in this federal building for three plus weeks. That is
militiamen slash activists. That's the difference.
Right.
These guys are activists, David, now.
No, they are
so
not
activists.
So you
have to take that into consideration. Now, those brothers at the Daily building would have been terrorists, but these are activists, and that's what makes it okay.
Protesting.
Exactly.
We're in Michigan.
We can have a good time on this show.
We can. We can do this all day.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and get to business on Flint, Michigan. I've got some amazing information. My mind is just blown literally every day with this. Michael Moore put together a piece, 10 Things About the Flint Water Crisis. And I just want to reference a few of the things that he talked about. We don't have time for all 10, but a few of these things really stuck out to me. And let me just say before I even get to the countdown, so to speak, just my individual thoughts. To me, it is just heartbreaking, and it is really beyond my reckoning and understanding. In 2016, in the United States of America, far and away the biggest economy, the biggest military, the richest country in the world, that people don't have water.
Yeah.
And as much as we can talk about Flint and their problems, and Flint also being a microcosm of problems, because there are other cities that have this problem. I just saw one on Jackson, Mississippi.
Sebring, Ohio.
Exactly. We could go on. There are other cities in this country that are having issues with water. But let's just put it in perspective. That's just the United States. And oftentimes, we are guilty of viewing our worldview through the lens of this individual country, which only makes up, 5% of the population of the world?
Uh-huh.
There are people in this world who would kill for some Flint water.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that from the perspective that the people in Flint should be happy for the water that they have. It's not that argument. People in Africa are starving. It's not that argument. It is to say that around this world, something that should be a human right,
mm-hmm.
many people do not have and have situations that are far worse than Flint.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Flint is here.
Right.
It's happening in the richest country in the world. So I just want people to think about just think about that as you consider whatever position you take about Flint. There are people suffering far greater for water than just in Flint, Michigan. But here's the deal. Michael Moore highlighted this. While children in Flint were giving poison water to drink, General Motors was given a special hookup for clean water. So basically, a few months after Governor Snyder removed Flint from the clean, fresh water they had been drinking for decades, the brass from General Motors went to him and complained that the Flint River was causing their car parts to corrode. The governor then subsequently spent $440,000 to hook GM back up to the Lake Huron water while keeping the rest of Flint on the Flint River water, which means that while the children of Flint were drinking lead-filled water, there was one and only one address in Flint that got clean water, and that's the GM factory. And we're going to, we can certainly make, have a conversation about Republican policies, how that ties back into that, picking profits over people. That's a whole, but that is indicative of that whole mindset and that ideology. Here's one thing, your favorite thing, and I got some actual clarification on this. This is going to make you even more disgusted. And I'm, when I say you, I'm talking to David, by the way, my good people. For just $100 a day, this crisis could have been prevented. Yes, we know that, right? We've talked about that. You highlighted that on this show many times. But here's the deal. It only would have taken $100 a day for 3 months, not the year. So we're talking, they would have, they did all this to save $9,000. So the state government said, forget it. And as a result, this may end up costing in actual dollars $1.5 billion. They're going to need a Powerball. The state of Michigan is going to be playing tickets, praying they win to pay this crisis, because not because they didn't want to spend $30,000 or $300,000, $9,000 is the fix that it would have taken for this, because all they had to do was add an anti-corrosive element to the water for 3 months at $100 a day. So here's the other thing.
Well, but they also, you know what else, Ativa? They also have to care and place at least the value of $9,000 on the lives that are affected by this travesty.
Absolutely.
So those lives have to be worth at least $9,000 for them to have spent that money.
And before you go any further, and I'm going to get the information, I read this information and I hadn't put it together on Flint, Michigan, on the Flint water crisis. And I want to make sure that I get all of this information together. But for those of us who are listening, and for my two co-hosts, the real reason, because again, even if you say to yourself $9,000, why wouldn't Rick Snyder, Governor Rick Snyder, and the state of Michigan go ahead and spend $9,000? That's not a lot of money. So it was never so it can't be about the $9,000, because they knew. They knew that if the longer they let these people drink this water, that they were going to have a bigger bill down the road. Here's the little known secret, and when we do this follow up story, I promise that I'm going to have all of the information. Here's the little known secret why they allowed the Flint River to continue to be as bad as it was. Rick Snyder was in the process of privatizing the water coming out of the Flint River to one of his cronies in the city of Michigan, and it, by allowing the condition of the water to stay as bad as it was, he could sell it at a lower price to one of his cronies. That's the real reason that the Flint River was allowed to get as bad as it was and stay as bad as it was, so that one of his cronies could come in and buy the Flint River so he could privatize it, because that's all we're talking about when we're talking about Michigan. We're talking about these emergency managers that are going in and taking over locally elected people and privatizing the decision-making and taking it away, which is what is which a lot of the national coverage, the national media coverage, has tried to place the blame at the mayor of Flint and the city council of Flint, and it had nothing to do with them because these emergency managers went in and took it over. But the real reason is in trying to privatize this waterway, he had to let the condition of the water stay as poor as it was, so he could so he had to sell it at a lower price.
So follow the money.
And that's the ultimate, most disgusting part of this story, is that they poisoned 100,000 people so they could privatize the waterway and sell it at a discount so that people could make more money.
I think
follow the money.
I think Dave is feeling that, and that's what we're here for, is to give voice to the voiceless, because there should be more outrage, there should be more anger, and I have a question coming up, and we'll answer that and get out of here, but I want to know, does this rise to the level then of criminality? But before we do that, I want to make one more point, because this is something I didn't know. While they were being poisoned, they were also being bombed. Did anybody know that?
Being bombed by whom?
I'm about to tell you. Here's a story that has received little or no coverage outside of Flint. During those 2 years of water contamination, residents in Flint have had to contend with a decision made by the Pentagon to use Flint to target practice. Literally. Actual unannounced military exercises, complete with live ammo and explosives, were conducted last year in the city of Flint. The Army decided to practice urban warfare on Flint, making use of the thousands of abandoned homes which they could drop bombs on. Streets with dilapidated homes had rocket-propelled grenades fired upon them for weeks. An undisclosed number of Army troops pretended Flint was Baghdad or Damascus and basically had at it. It sounded as if the city was under attack from invading army or terrorists. People were shocked this could be going on in their neighborhoods. So, and then, so this is what Michael Moore had added to his site. I have gone to then to substantiate this. CBS 5, WNEM out of Saginaw, Michigan. They confirmed this on their website as of June 2nd, 2015. Yes, the U.S. Army finished its training exercises in Flint on June 10th. The training was to ensure the Army's ability to operate in urban environments, said Jason Lorenz, city spokesperson. This is real. This is real. So not only are the people subject to now Legionnaires' disease, lead poisoning potentially for generations, but they've also had the U.S. government, the Pentagon, blowing up the houses in the neighborhood. And we'll even discuss then what the water crisis itself has done to completely decimate home values in Flint. So this is what we're dealing with.
All the while being billed for the water. Don't forget that part.
Yes. No, not only being billed, getting shutoff notices sent when they didn't pay the bill.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Bills for your poison.
I have to say this. I know we're coming to a close, but I think we have to end the show on this note. Unless you are the richest 1%, I'll even say unless you are the richest 10% in the United States, what possible platform does the Republican Party espouse that you would vote for a Republican to represent you? That's all I got to ask.
You know, you and I have had this discussion, Dave, and it is just beyond my understanding is taking race completely out of the conversation. When you look at the economy, when you look at the job creation during Republican years versus Democratic years, when you look at who leaves a deficit versus who leaves a surplus, when you look at just about anything that is measurable and quantifiable, I have no idea why someone who is not in the 1% could vote Republican, because everything that we're talking about with Flint, as disgusting as it is not simply about a callousness to human life. It is about a Republican ideology of trickle-down economics that we have proven time and time again does not work. Rashida, I'd like to give you the last word.
For most of us, that does not work for the bottom 99. And some of us will vote it anyway just because it's what we've always done or it's what our grandfather did or this is our tradition and, you know, we don't know how to move away from anything and heaven forbid we make a change, even if it makes sense to make. But I concur with my co-host, with my team. I can't think of one reason, not based on anything they've done, not based on anything they said. And many of the issues that we talk about on this show, they don't even get 4 seconds at the debate. You know, they're not even thinking about solutions to any of these things that we talk about. And for that reason, they can't have my vote.
Absolutely. With that said, the Iowa caucuses are tomorrow.
That they are.
And we're nervous, so we're all excited. So since we're doing predictions.
Let the circus begin.
Right, since we're doing predictions. Rashida, you go first this time.
Oh, yeah, that's a tough call for me still. I'm going to tell you what I hope doesn't happen. I hope Trump does not do anything in Iowa.
Well, who do you have on the Democratic ticket for Iowa?
Who do I want or who do I know is going to get it?
Who do you know is going to get it? We're predicting winning.
Okay, well, win is relative, but Clinton will get it.
All right. She's got Hillary for tomorrow. Who do you have?
I'm predicting Hillary in Iowa by at least 7 percentage points. And I'm predicting Ted Cruz in Iowa tomorrow by at least 10 percentage points. I think that the caucuses and the pre-polling that they have been doing has been really screwed up. I think Ted Cruz is going to pull it out. The people who are supporting Trump are not going to show up to caucus. Same thing for Bernie, which is why I'm predicting Hillary by a minimum of 7, and Trump by, Ted Cruz by 10.
All right, so I just got one thing to say. Feel the burn. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next week on We Hear You.
I love it.